Thanks very much for that, Damien. I'm very pleased to be back in my hometown today. As Damien said, I'm a graduate of Adelaide Uni from the Economics Department. So what I'm going to do today is to talk to you about the Reserve Bank's dealings in financial markets. So why might you actually be interested in that topic? I assume most of you have a mortgage, some of you have a mortgage, and some of you, those who don't have a mortgage, I at least assume probably have a deposit. So what we do in financial markets each day affects the rate that you pay on your mortgage or that you get on your deposit. So I'm going to talk a bit about how what we do affects the rate you get on that. And as Damien said, also I'm going to talk a bit about the exchange rate and what we do around the exchange rate, what we, the Reserve Bank, do around the exchange rate and some of the factors which are driving the exchange rate at the moment. So let me start with what we actually do in terms of implementing the board's monetary policy. So I'll start with how we set the cash rate. So as you all know, on the first Tuesday of each month, except January, we get January off, the board of the Reserve Bank meets to determine the appropriate stance of monetary policy in Australia. So at 2:30 p.m., just after the conclusion of the board meeting, the governor issues a press release announcing the board's decision, along with an explanation for the decision that the board took. And that decision takes the form of a target for the cash rate. And it's the job of part of my area, Financial Markets Group, to actually ensure that when the board says this is what the cash rate shall be, that it is what it is. So how do we actually go about doing this? I'm going to try and not make this too esoteric so I can get on to how it actually affects the rates you pay, but I think it provides you a bit of context for what we're actually doing. So the cash rate is interest rate on overnight borrowing in the interbank market. So it's, if I'm a bank and I want to borrow from another bank, it's how much I have to pay to borrow overnight, just one day. So it's just the rate, interest rate the banks charge each other is to borrow and lend overnight. The Reserve Bank's ability to affect this interest rate comes from the fact that we control completely the amount of funds or liquidity in this market. So banks have to hold deposit accounts with us at the Reserve Bank called exchange settlement accounts. And these are the accounts that basically underpin the whole plumbing of the financial system in Australia. So when you pay your electricity bill, say, by direct debit, the funds are effectively transferred from your bank account across the exchange settlement account with us of your bank to that of your electricity company's bank and into the electricity company's account. So all the payment flows that you make every day in the economy go through these exchange settlement accounts each day. So very large number of transactions are settled each day. These exchange settlement accounts that the banks have to hold with us must always have positive balances, so we don't let the banks go into overdraft with us. At the end of each day, the balance in these accounts are paid an interest rate of 25 basis points, which is 0.25%, below the cash rate. So the banks have to hold this money with us and they get paid 25 basis points below the cash rate. If a bank finds that its projected balance looks like it's going below zero, it has to borrow from us overnight at an interest rate of 25 points above the cash rate. So they have to pay a penalty rate to do that. So given that they have to pay a penalty rate to do that, they don't want to do that, they have a strong incentive to manage their liquidity so they have just enough funds in those accounts, but not too much. So if they think, so during the course of the day, if they think they're going to have too much funds, then they try and lend it to one of the other banks at the cash rate. If they think they're going to not have enough funds, then they try and borrow it from another bank at the cash rate to avoid either leaving too much money, getting paid too little, or having to borrow at too expensive a price. So how do we come into that? Because so far I've just talked about how a bank borrows from another bank. So how we control this market is that we determine the total amount of funds in the market. We have complete control of the supply. So the demand comes from all the banks having to hold their accounts. The supply comes from us and only us. And it's the interaction of this supply and demand each day which determines the cash rate. So if in aggregate the banking system wants to hold more balances with us, then we increase the supply to stop the cash rate from moving up as the banks bid more aggressively to borrow from each other. If they want to hold less, we decrease the supply, otherwise banks would start trying to lend to each other below the cash rate to offload their excess funds. So it's very much a simple issue of demand and supply, except in this instance, we are the only supplier and then the banking system is the demander. So the Reserve Bank controls the supply of funds through our daily open market operations, which is, this is probably taking some of you back to some stuff you never really wanted to ever hear about again from your economics days or business school days. In your textbooks, open market operations were probably described in terms of purchases or sales of government securities by the central bank. And we do a bit of that, but not a lot. Most of what we do is we actually do things which are called repurchase agreements or repos. So we lend cash to a bank, they give us a security, or they lend us a security, a government security, back for a period of time, generally a week or two, at the end of which we reverse the transaction. We give them back the cash and they return the security. These repo transactions allow the Reserve Bank to manage the day-to-day fluctuations in liquidity, which are mostly caused by cash flows in and out of the Australian government's deposit account with us. So that's the other important institution which has a bank account with us, which is the government. When you pay your taxes, the money comes into the government's account with us and it comes out of the financial system. When the government goes out and buys something, or spend some money building a school or whatever, the money goes out of the government's bank account with us and into the financial system. So each day there are also a myriad of these flows going backwards and forwards between the government and the rest of the economy, and that injects and withdraws liquidity from the economy every day. And we, through our open market operations, have to offset the impact of all of that. So we aim to offset these liquidity flows so that the overall supply of liquidity and the banking system's total demand for it match at the cash rate. Now, this interbank market is actually incredibly small. It's only about $1 billion each day, which is very, very small in size, given that the Australian economy is well over $1 trillion. So this one very small market, which is only about $1 billion, actually influences the whole structure of interest rates in the whole economy. I said it comes from the fact, and our control over it comes from the fact that we have complete control over the supply of funds in this market. The fact also that we deal in the market each day ourselves means that we get a very good sense of what's going on in domestic financial markets. And this direct market liaison was invaluable at the height of market stress in 2008 and 2009. So if we're looking at what was going on in financial markets in 2008 and 2009, most of the stresses were much more offshore than onshore, but even in our own domestic markets there was quite a bit of stress, and this the money market or the cash market was where a lot of these stresses were most evident. And the fact that we're in those markets every day gives us a very good sense of what's going on. So having talked, I'm now going to move away from the sort of esoteric side of things and get on to what really matters to you, which is how this all of this actually affects the interest rate you actually pay on your mortgage or you get on your deposit. So the cash rate, this is effectively the anchor point for all interest rates in the economy. So even though I said this market is incredibly small, it's only about $1 billion, and banks fund only a very, very small part of their operations in the cash market, ultimately all of the funding that the banking system raises can be arbitraged back to the cash market. If they borrow at terms longer than overnight, then the interest rate they're paying is basically the weighted average of the expected future path of the cash rate. So where the cash rate is today and where it's expected to go pretty much determines the rate they borrow if they borrow for a longer term, plus there's a little bit added on for risk. If it was cheaper for them to borrow at a long, if it was cheaper them to borrow overnight than borrow at a longer term, then all they'd do is they'd borrow overnight and keep on rolling that every day. So all the longer term rates end up being basically tied back to the cash rate. A bank will similarly price its deposit based on the cash rate for an at-call deposit. So if you've got an at-call deposit or an online deposit, you'll see that it's basically priced off the cash rate. Because again, a deposit is an alternative source of funding for the banks as well as the cash market. For term deposits, which are particularly popular at the moment, again, a bank will price them based on the expected future path of the cash rate. They don't want to pay more than they need to get your funds, and if they've got alternatively cheaper sources of funding, they'll use them. In recent times, for those of you who do have a deposit, you've probably noticed there's been a lot of competition for them, which has seen interest rates paid on deposits rise quite considerably relative to the cash rate. This competition has arisen from a desire by banks to increase the share of deposit funding resulting from a number of factors, including the fact of lessons learned during the crisis. So during the crisis, a number of banks discovered that some forms of funding weren't quite as reliable as others, And the general consensus was, by both banks and also under pressure from rating agencies, that deposits were a more stable source of funding. That's why the banks are willing to pay you more for a deposit than they used to. So fluctuations in those competitive forces and those sort of regulatory forces means that deposit rates don't always move in lockstep with the cash rate. As I said, you can get about 100 or more than 1.5 percentage points more for a deposit today relative to the cash rate than you could have 3 years ago. So so while the cash rates are a very large influence on deposit rates, they're not the only influence. When a bank wants to borrow at longer terms, longer-term rates are priced above the expected path of the cash rate to compensate the lender for the greater risks they are taking for lending for longer periods of time. Now, the other thing which happened during the crisis in particular was that lenders demanded a lot more compensation to compensate them for that risk. So you saw during the crisis that banks had to pay about 3 or 4 percentage points more for longer term funding than they had previously, because people were concerned, you know, not so much here but elsewhere, about whether that bank was actually going to be around, you know, come the end of that loan. And in some cases, if you look at some of the American banks which failed, they weren't actually around by the time you got to the end of the loan. So lenders demanded a lot more compensation for that. Credit premia rose quite dramatically in 2008 and 2009. They've come down a lot over the last few years, and particularly over the last 6 months. But risk premia faced by banks remain significantly higher than they were in the years leading up to 2007, when they were extremely small. So these risk premia move around independently of the cash rate, but it is still the case that the cash rate has a very large influence on the whole structure that underlies the interest rates faced by banks and others looking to borrow funds. So the cash rate is still a very large determinant of the bank's cost of funding. If we were to turn around and increase the cash rate by 3 percentage points today — that's not what we're actually going to do, but if we were going to do that — the whole structure of funding costs for the banking system would shift up by around the same amount. So this effect of the cash rate on the cost of banks' funding translates into a large effect on the structure of lending rates for both businesses and households. So the banks base these lending rates, the rates they set on their mortgages or the rates they lend to businesses, on their cost of funding, along with a premium to compensate them for the riskiness of the loan being made. That is, how likely are you to repay the loan that the bank's given you? In addition, there's a bit of a markup to generate a return for bank shareholders. So the cash rate has a large influence on lending rates, but there are these other factors which I've tried to talk about, such as credit risk premium, competitive pressures in the deposit market, as well as changes in the mix of funding that banks use. They're using a lot more deposits now than they used to in the past, which means that the relationship over the medium term between the cash rate and lending rates may not always be one for one. So in the years before 2007, particularly in the decade before 2007, the cash rate and lending rates tended to move pretty much in lockstep. These other factors weren't moving around much at all. Risk premia were incredibly low, so changes in lending rates did tend to move in line with the cash rate. So coming back to what Damien was talking about earlier, anyone who grew up or started borrowing money in the 90s and in the 2000s probably thought that the mortgage rates always moved in lockstep with the cash rate, but that was actually more the aberration rather than the norm. And now we're back in a world where lending rates move generally in line with the cash rate, but they certainly don't move one for one. And that's because of a material change in a number of those other factors which affect lending rates. But, and I suppose the point I really want to take away today, it is still the cash rate which is still the predominant determinant of changes in lending rates, even though that relationship is not one for one. So the Reserve Bank still has a very large degree of control over the structure of lending rates in the economy, notwithstanding, as I said, the amount of heat and light which gets generated every time a bank doesn't quite move in lockstep with the cash rate. So having talked a bit about what we do on the lending rate side of things, let me talk a bit about what we do on the foreign exchange side of things. And I'll talk first about the bank's transactions in foreign exchange markets. So we transact in foreign exchange markets for a number of reasons. And the main one is that we, as well as doing the government's banking business, we also do their foreign exchange business. So, for example, when the Department of Foreign Affairs needs to pay its embassy in Washington in US dollars, we, the Reserve Bank, sell the government the necessary US dollars to make that payment, and we get some Australian dollars in exchange. Generally, we purchase the US dollars in the market, in the foreign exchange market, prior to settlement. So we do have the option of funding the sale of US dollars out of our foreign exchange reserves, which I'll talk about in a minute. Well, on average, we do around $30 million of foreign exchange transactions for the government every day, and then every once in a while we do a few hundred million dollars if they're, you know, have to go out and buy a big aircraft. No, we don't have aircraft carriers, but if they have to go out and buy a destroyer or something like that, then we have to do a large foreign exchange payment. So, yeah, but on average, we do around $30 million a day. So one benefit of this regular interaction that with us having to transact in the market each day is that we get useful intelligence about developments in the foreign exchange market. And this flow of information helps us to form a view about market conditions in real time and can provide and can prove invaluable in times of market stress. So I use the information we get from our interaction both the domestic and the foreign exchange market to provide some background colour to my briefings to the Reserve Bank Board each month on financial market developments. So we do these foreign exchange transactions for the government, but we also do a decent number of transactions because we manage the country's foreign exchange reserves. So these amount currently to around about $36 billion Australian dollars, but they're all held in foreign currency. So, but there's $36 billion is the value in Aussie dollars. So about 45% of these reserves are held in US dollars, 45% are held in euros, and they're a little bit split between yen and Canadian dollars. And the bank has a very conservative approach to managing the reserves, so that we only hold nearly all of our portfolios invested in government securities, but nevertheless we're transacting in those markets every day. And the day-to-day, we run a 24-hour trading operation, so we have traders in New York, London and in Sydney. So we basically, our trading day starts at 5:30 on a Monday morning and goes all the way through to 5 p.m. New York time, which is 9 a.m. Sydney on a 9 a.m. on a Saturday morning in Sydney time. So in between times, we've got people transacting on our behalf, our staff transacting in the market all the way through the week. So the transactions that we do each day in managing the portfolio again provide us with very useful market intelligence. So we have a lot of transactions in the US government bond market, in the European government bond markets, which provide us with a lot of information about what's actually going on in those markets. So why is it that we hold $36 billion in foreign currency? Why not some other amount, or why any at all? One reason is that we need to hold some reserves to fund Australia's potential commitments to global financial institutions like the IMF or the World Bank, but that's a relatively small part of the story. The main motivation is to provide the capacity for the Reserve Bank to intervene in the foreign exchange market when necessary. So over the past 2 decades, we have on occasion intervened to basically manage an orderly depreciation of the Australian dollar when conditions in the market warranted. So it's a long way away from where we are today, but the most recent episode wasn't all that long ago. It's back in 2008, 2009. So at times, as you probably remember, there were various bouts of tension in the markets as stresses flared in global markets, particularly following the failure of Lehman Brothers, when basically, for all intents and purposes, global financial markets pretty much came to a stop. Many participants stepped back from the market, particularly concerns about whether the person they were dealing with was actually going to be there the next day. And as I said earlier, in some cases that was a fairly valid concern. If your counterparty was Lehman Brothers, then lo and behold, they weren't there the next day. Similarly with Bear Stearns. So the bank was able to use our foreign exchange reserves to inject liquidity into the market, into the Australian dollar market in these disorderly conditions. We were willing to be the counterparty on the other side of these transactions, and people were always willing to deal with us in a way that they weren't willing to deal with some of the other counterparties. We weren't trying to prevent the Australian dollar depreciating back then, as I said, a long way removed from where we are today. But we weren't trying to prevent the Australian dollar depreciating back then. We actually wanted the currency to depreciate. We were just concerned with basically the speed with which it was depreciating. So what was tending to happen back then is as people were pulling back from the market, the markets basically stopped being a market in the sense that there was no one there willing to make a price. When that happens, the market tends to gap quite a bit. And so we stepped into the market and were basically the ones willing to be on the other side of transactions to make sure there was actually a price in the market. In that intervention episode in 2008-2009, we only used around $3.8 billion of reserves, which might sound a large number, but it's actually not relative to the size of the foreign exchange market. Most of the transactions we did in the market back then were extremely small, only about $1 or $2 million at a time. No one was actually looking to trade large amounts of foreign exchange back in 08 and 09. Everyone was extremely scared and just having to do only the minimum amount of transactions. If I go back a bit earlier to 2001, which, if you remember, was when the Australian dollar reached an all-time low of 47 cents against the US dollar, at that time, we were intervening in the market, but the size of our intervention was considerably larger. We were doing about $1 billion a day on one day alone. What was happening back then was some very large hedge funds were taking very large positions against the Australian dollar. So the size of the transactions we had to do to support the currency back then were extremely large. In 08 and 09, by contrast, they were extremely small. No one was willing to take any position on anything. As it turns out, both the 2008-2009 episode and the 2001 one were actually extremely profitable for the bank and then ultimately the Australian taxpayer. So what we basically did was we bought Australian dollars low and sold them high. So buying anything low and selling them high, generally a good way to make money. That's what we did. Others weren't willing to do that because, again, in 2008-2009 people were scared, but one advantage of sitting there with a very long horizon with a large balance sheet is that you can take those sort of positions. Making money is actually not our aim. That's a useful byproduct of what we do. What we're aiming to do is make sure that the market functions properly. As I said, the fact that that comes along with making a bit of income on the side for the Australian taxpayer is great. But the main aim is actually make sure the market functions properly. Now, let me bring up to a more recent period. So in the second half of last year, some of you may be aware, there was a reasonable amount of discussion, particularly in the financial press, about some of the bank's transactions in the foreign exchange market, about our transactions in the foreign exchange market. So I'm going to take this opportunity just to run through the details of this, which might be of some interest. It certainly was of some interest to some journalists back then. The bank offers foreign... So what we do, as I said earlier, we offer foreign exchange services to all of our customers, not just the Australian government. So we have, as I said earlier, we mostly do foreign exchange transactions on behalf of the government. We also have some other customers that we do foreign exchange transactions for. So very occasionally, one of those other customers, which are from offshore, let us know that they'd like to buy some Australian dollars to invest in Australia, and they ask to purchase them through us. After we've sold them the Australian dollars for foreign currency, then we at the bank have to decide whether we want to retain that foreign exchange we've just bought or whether we want to sell it back into the market because we don't want to hold any more foreign exchange reserves. So with the Australian dollar trading at what we assessed was the high end of valuation at the time, so this is the second half of last year, we decided on that occasion it would be appropriate to hang on to some of that foreign exchange in our reserves portfolio rather than sell it back into the market. That is, we thought, and we still think, that foreign exchange was on the cheap side of fair value, that the Australian dollar is on the high side. If we had sold the foreign exchange back into the market that we got from this customer, we would have been in there, we, the Reserve Bank, would have been in there, buying back Australian dollars, putting upward pressure on the currency at a time when we already thought it was reasonably high. So we decided that probably wasn't a good idea, and so we decided to hold on to the foreign exchange. So as I said, we made that assessment late last year, on the basis that we had this transaction sort of opportunistically came along and thought, okay, we did the transaction and rather than selling that foreign exchange and buying more Australian dollars, we'd hang on to it and not contribute to any more upward pressure on the currency. So having said, we just said that our assessment is the Australian dollar is somewhat on the high side, let me talk a bit about why that is, and this comes to one of the points Damien made in the introduction. So the primary reason, I think, for the Australian dollar being higher and the state of the Australian economy and the Australian terms of trade would suggest is basically the weak state of many advanced economies. So if you think about an exchange rate, it's a relative price. So if our exchange rate's high, it's because someone else's is low. And the main reason why other people's exchange rates are low is because of the very weak state of their economies and as a result, the policies being pursued by central banks in those countries. So having lowered interest rates as far as they can in a number of these countries, basically to zero, these central banks have embarked on a very large expansion of their balance sheets, buying assets, mostly government securities, from the private sector. And one of the main channels by which this quantitative easing is expected to work is in by encouraging the private sector, who's just sold them the government securities, to use the cash to buy other assets. Now, those other assets include foreign assets. So if I'm sitting there in the US, the Fed's just come along and bought a government security off me, I've got this cash, I have to decide what to do with it. One of the things I might want to do with it is go and buy an asset somewhere else in the world, including Australia. So the actions of these central banks are understandable and defensible from their domestic policy perspectives. However, these policy actions do have an impact on other countries. So as some of this quantitative easing generates capital outflows, as people in those countries go and buy foreign assets, the exchange rate, so in this case, say, the US dollar, depreciates, boosting local economic activities. But as I said, an exchange rate is a relative price. If the US dollar is going down, someone else is going up. When one country's exchange rate depreciates, another must appreciate. And the exchange rate movement transfers demand from one country to another. So if the US dollar is depreciating, it's transferring demand from somewhere else in the world to the US. So if you go back again to probably a concept you didn't want to hear again after you finished your economics or business degree, there's an income and a substitution effect at work here. Quite likely, these policy actions of those global central banks are boosting demand in the world as a whole. So the income effect is positive. But if the exchange rate appreciation is large enough in a particular country, or if a country doesn't trade all that much with the one doing this quantitative easing, the effect of the appreciation of the exchange rate may outweigh the positive effect of stronger global demand. That is, for a given economy, the substitution effect of a higher exchange rate may dominate the income effect. This is particularly likely to be the case for a smaller country, where the size of the capital inflows it attracts may be large relative to the size of the economy. So if you think about the Australian economy, just as an example, which is quite small relative to the size of the US, a small amount of capital inflow from the outflow from the US's perspective can be very large for us. The best example recently is probably Switzerland, when people were very concerned about the euro breaking up and funds were flowing out of Europe and into Switzerland. The size of the outflows were large, even from the Europeans' perspective, but they're incredibly large from the Swiss perspective and basically swamped the Swiss economy. So while it's the case that the monetary policy settings we see around the world at the moment might be good for the global economy as a whole, and that point's debatable, they still may not be beneficial for any individual country. And that can leave those countries that are receiving these inflows with a very difficult choice. They can decide to offset the effects of the higher exchange rate with expansionary policy too. So we can respond in Australia to the fact that we have a higher exchange rate than we expect by lowering our interest rates too. A number of commentators say that this is clearly a good thing for the global economy. And they do highlight the fact that it's in stark contrast to the 1930s, which was the last time where we went through a world of competitive depreciation, where countries responded with tighter policies. So instead of responding with looser policies, they responded with tighter policies, and that was, you know, the 1930s didn't turn out all that well for the global economy, or actually the world as a whole. So the argument is that given a shortfall in global demand, the fact that other countries' exchange rates are going up and forcing them to run more expansionary policy must be a good thing for the world as a whole, given that there's no scope for the big economies to lower their interest rates any further. But lowering rates to such low levels can cause some problems. It can generate excess credit expansion or asset price inflation or imbalances elsewhere in the economy. So the current experiences of Canada, Hong Kong and Switzerland are relevant in this respect. So if you're not aware, so the Swiss have been forced to have lowered their interest rates to zero. They've also accumulated large foreign exchange reserves. Borrowing rates in Switzerland are very close to zero, and the Swiss are experiencing a housing boom. The house prices are rising quite dramatically. Canada's having the same problem. Canadian interest rates are around 1% at the moment. Their cash rate equivalent is about 1%. And they've experienced an extremely strong house price rises over the last 4 or 5 years. So that the fact that they've been forced to lower interest rates to such low levels is causing them a fair bit of grief at the moment. So the response of those who say this is still a good thing is that such concerns can be alleviated by the appropriate deployment of the buzzword now in global policy circles is called macroprudential, which basically means going back to the sort of things we had in the 1970s where we had caps on interest rates, caps on credit provision and that sort of thing. So the argument is that those tools should be deployed once you get interest rates down to zero and you're worried about excess credit growth. But there are large uncertainties about how effective such tools really are, and the experience during the 1970s with such tools and into the 80s before financial deregulation was that ultimately they tend to be unsuccessful. To date in Australia, we've been able to counter the effects of the higher Australian dollar with lower interest rates. So we have responded to the fact that the exchange rate is higher by lowering interest rates here. And my colleague, the Deputy Governor Phil Lowe, discussed these sort of considerations at the end of last year. In Australia, obviously, we still retain the scope to lower interest rates further. Interest rates here aren't at zero, as you're probably all aware. So we still have the capacity to lower rates further should the need arise, including to counter the pressures of an elevated exchange rate. So in thinking about where we've got the economy at the moment, the board's consideration is very much that the exchange rate is exerting a sort of contractionary effect on the economy, and to offset that effect, they've lowered interest rates to provide stimulus to the economy. Now, in the normal state of affairs, lowering interest rates tends to also lower your exchange rate. That obviously hasn't happened over the past 6 or 9 months. The exchange rate's still basically where it was before the board commenced the most recent easing cycle. So that sort of transmission channel of monetary policy isn't working the way it normally does, but others still are. And it comes back to what I was talking about right at the beginning, is that when we lower the cash rate, your borrowing rates are lower. This, you know, borrowing rates today are basically as low as they've ever been for businesses, and for your mortgage, it's only just a little bit higher than where it got to in 2009, but otherwise about the lowest mortgage rate that there's been in the past 40 years. So those transmission channels of monetary policy are still very much working, and the Reserve Bank's ability to set the cash rate and then influence those that structure of interest rates in the economy is still very much there. So while that relationship is not as exact as it was, say, prior to 2007, where movements in the cash rate moved lending rates one for one, the relationship is still pretty good. The borrowing rates are still materially lower than they were a couple of years ago because the cash rate is lower. So I hope that's given you some idea about how the Reserve Bank actually goes about influencing the macro settings in the economy. We've got one tool basically, which is the cash rate. But it's still that tool which only operates in a very small market, that interbank market, still affects the whole structure of interest rates in the economy, both lending and deposit rates. And I hope I've been able to give you some idea about what we do in the foreign exchange market and some of the factors affecting the exchange rate at the moment. I think those factors are obviously playing out right at the moment, particularly with things which are going on in Japan and elsewhere. And I think it's going to be extremely interesting to see how that plays out over the course of the year, over this year, and what that implies for the domestic exchange rate. So let me finish there. As I said, I hope that's given you some of a background about what we actually do from an operational sense in financial markets at the Reserve Bank, and very happy to take any questions on along those lines. So.
Thank you, Guy. We've got two roving mics, and if you could put your hand up, we'll try and get there. Please don't ask the question until you get a mic, but I suppose I can reserve the first right for a question. It seems odd to me that both Switzerland and Canada are now going through a housing boom. Are we looking for another bubble that's going to crash, similar to what happened in the States?
In those two countries?
Yes.
Well, they're very worried about it. They're hoping that that's... certainly hoping that it's not going to happen, but at least at the moment they're reasonably confident that it's not going to happen. The Swiss case is actually interesting, because if you think, as I said, there was a large amount of people taking their money out of Europe and putting it into Switzerland. Now, one of the ways they did that was actually taking cash and buying, you know, Swiss houses, basically, as a way to store their cash. So it's not... the Swiss story is not necessarily a credit-fueled one like the US.
Yeah.
It's just a large amount of money moving into Switzerland. The Canadian story is much more a lot of lending, large house price boom. I mean, the Canadian economy's experienced similar developments to Australia in the sense, obviously, they've got a lot of minerals which are earning them a lot of money at the moment. So that's supporting that rise in house prices. But there is a reasonable amount of concern in Canada, including at the Bank of Canada, about developments in the housing market there.
We'll think about that in 2040. So if you any questions, please put your hand up and say who you are and where you're from.
Cowed everyone into submission.
Okay, we've got one over there.
Thanks, Guy. Reuben Broadfoot from the Commonwealth Bank. Just a quick question on intervention. Obviously, Glenn commented on Friday that the Aussie is higher than where the RBA expected it would be at the moment. At what level would you look to intervene in the currency market? And if so, how long could you sustain intervening to keep the currency lower?
So I'm not going to answer the first question. at what level? Probably a bit higher than today. Because we haven't obviously thus far, but I mean that will depend on the context, I suppose. What in terms of the second question, which is easier to answer, so one mistaken view that people often have is that you know we have limited firepower to intervene in the currency market. Now that's true if the currency is falling. It's not true if the currency is rising. So to cap, and the Swiss a good example of that, there's no limit on your on our ability to supply Australian dollars. We can do that till the cows come home. We have more Australian dollars than anyone else in the world, you know, because we print them. So so unlike on the other side of the story, when the currency's falling, we only, you know, I said we have $36 billion worth of foreign exchange reserves. That's all we have. So if the currency's falling and we're selling those, there's a limit to that. When the currency's rising, and if you're intervening to cap a rising currency, you have, you know, you have more than anyone else has. And as you know, the Swiss, a very clear example of that at the moment. Just to put the Swiss in comparison, so the Swiss economy, the Swiss have around about half a trillion in foreign exchange reserves today. If Switzerland's a smaller economy than Australia is, if you translate into how much that would be, if we we're going down the Swiss line, we'd be having over about a trillion in foreign exchange reserves. We currently have 36 billion, we'd have a trillion in foreign exchange reserves. So that gives you some idea about the size of the intervention that the Swiss have done over the last couple of years.
David?
David Saint, University of Adelaide. I'm not an economist, which will become obvious when I say this question. I was watching a program on TV about the philosophical divide between Keynes and Hayek.
Yep.
And if I understand it, the world's gone very Keynesian. But Hayek says that the reason that we get these boom and bust cycles is because governments really don't understand the system. It's too complicated, and they'd be better off if they didn't fiddle with it and just went and sat on the beach. Has anyone ever actually tried that, or is that just too big a...
I'm all in favour of sitting on the beach, but so arguably, I mean, you know, that's a difficult question to answer in a couple of minutes, but arguably the US was very Hayekian before 2007. There was the government, and this is a contentious point, but the government arguably got right out of the way and let markets do their stuff, and we've seen what happens. Also, what's, you know, the words Keynesian and Hayekian are often used as, you know, don't necessarily actually represent the views of the two, of Keynes and Hayek, but and taken often sort of used as straw men, but. I think in the period up to 2007 in the US in particular, at least, was broadly a period of unfettered markets. Now there were various, you know, arguably there were some government policy actions which contributed as well, but that was certainly an area where, you know, completely deregulated financial markets did their stuff and, you know, said the consequences weren't all that pretty. So that probably wasn't a good advertisement for that policy approach. A different variant of, or different variant of that argument, though, is that you know these countries which are pursuing these very expansionary monetary policies at the moment should just basically suck it up and you know and just deal with the, you know, they have to go through a very painful adjustment. They shouldn't just try to keep on postponing that. I mean, that's a harder question to address. And coming to the point Damien was talking about at the beginning, a lot of the reason why policymakers are doing what they're doing is because they looked at the experience of the Great Depression, where they, and the conclusion they took from that is policymakers didn't do enough, and they could have prevented 30, 40% unemployment by adopting more expansionary policies, and that the social costs of some going through another Great Depression are just not worth enduring. Now, that's a difficult question to answer as to where exactly that balance is. Clearly, there needs to be some sort of painful adjustment. The question is how much and how fast.
Tom Melville from Maddens. I'm not an economist either. I've just got a question that probably relates to the last couple of points that have been made. With the Swiss situation, where they're holding large amounts of foreign currency, I can see the advantages in that they can intervene to prevent their currency falling very rapidly in the future if need be, and also they've been able to, I suppose, arrest the increase in the value of their currency. Presumably there are some downsides. Would you be able to talk to those a little bit, please?
So the Swiss, when they imposed a ceiling on their exchange rate in 2011, already had deflation. So their prices were already falling, and their economy was basically in recession, and they already had interest rates at zero. If they'd let their currency go even higher, then they would have faced even worse, potentially quite damaging deflation. As it turns out today, even with them having capped their currency where it is, they still have deflation, although their economy is at least growing. The downsides are, one, you have to work out where you're going to invest those foreign exchange reserves, right? And so if you look around the world and you decide, you know, where am I going to place those reserves, do I, you know, they also, you know, you can't hold foreign reserves in your own currency, that's self-defeating, so that's out. So, you know, which countries are they confident about investing in? And that's obviously an issue. So it's, you know, it's a large portfolio to manage. If you think about managing $1 trillion, you know, there's only so many things you can buy with that. So that's difficult. There is, if they're ultimately successful, they don't have to worry about they don't have to worry about the value of that going down in their own currency terms. I don't think the Swiss are actually that worried about the Swiss franc falling very fast, very soon. In fact, they'd actually quite welcome it falling a fair way from where it is at the moment. So they're not holding the reserves in case the Swiss franc falls at some point in the future. They're purely holding them to cap the rise in their currency. And I think they'd be quite happy to see them gradually run down those reserves over the years ahead as the pressure is on the Swiss franc back off. But, I mean, the costs are really... the costs are really that you have to manage that large portfolio if ultimately you're unsuccessful. And in the end, maybe there's no great reason why you should be unsuccessful, because you can always keep on printing more of your own currency. But if you are, then you potentially suffer very large valuation loss on those foreign currency reserves. And also, the larger they get, you have to be concerned about the sort of credit risks that you're taking with those investments.
Let's go over here, John.
Hi, Sarah Martin from The Australian. Just back to your first question, the first question on intervention, could you just give us an indication as to what sort of confluence of circumstances would need to be present in the economy for the Reserve Bank to intervene and put a cap on the currency or any other sort of measures that might be considered?
I don't particularly want to go too far down that route right now. As I said, probably higher than where we are now. As I said, just coming back to the answer I gave to Tom's question, if you look at when the Swiss did what they did, they were facing deflation and a contracting economy, and with interest rates already at zero. So, and as I finished in my talk today, we still have some capacity to lower rates further should the need arise, and if the exchange rate is having, you know, still it continues to have a contractionary effect on the economy, we still have some scope to offset that with regular conventional monetary policy. So you know, that's not exhausted at this point.
Thank you. Chris Russell from The Advertiser, and sorry, don't want the media to dominate the questions, but given China is Australia's major trading partner, both for imports and exports, why does the Reserve Bank not hold much in renminbi, and is it something that you might do in future as the Chinese themselves are trying to get their currency to be an international trading currency?
I think that's conceivable, yes. The reason why is actually, even if you wanted to, up until very recently, you couldn't. So that's the very simple reason as to why not now, was that the Chinese didn't allow you to do it. That's only changed really in the last year or two. So can I think of that happening at some point in the future? Yeah, definitely. But as I said, up until now, it's basically been impossible. Only very recently have they even made it at all possible.
Any more questions? Happy to take more press questions.
Simon Lang from Simon Lang Wines. Just a question really that's a little different from the others that have been put to you. I was interested in the chance you would feel of the euro perhaps breaking up at some point in the future, firstly, and perhaps whether you think it even ought to continue on, or perhaps should, in what guise, and whether there'd been any need for or what sorts of changes would be required to maintain that currency as a viable one?
Yeah, that's a great question. So as it turns out, so breaking up a currency is extremely difficult. It hasn't happened much in history. So as it turns out, when I was at graduate school, I was a research assistant for Rudy Dornbusch. Now, those of you who did macroeconomics probably did, hopefully learned from Dornbusch and Fisher, so that was they were my two thesis advisors. But I did a project with Rudy looking at the breakup of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which ironically includes a very same number of similar number of number of similar countries to those who are in the euro today. So that broke up just after the First World War, at the end of the Habsburg Empire. It was a lot easier to break up a currency, and the Austro-Hungarian Empire had one currency, and then the empire fell apart and split up into a bunch of countries like. You know, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Austria, obviously, and what was then Yugoslavia. That was pretty difficult to do even in those days, and what they did was they just sealed the borders and they stamped the notes. So if you're in Czechoslovakia, they stamped the notes. This is a Czech note. You can't, you know, we won't accept any notes from Austria. But in those days, there weren't anything, you know, we didn't have electronic payments, for instance. So if you think about it, just the sheer nuts and bolts of trying to do that today, you think about everything which is literally hardwired into systems in Europe, incredibly difficult to actually try and do that. I mean, obviously, in the end, if you have the political will, maybe you can. But if you think about the logistics, extremely difficult. That's forgetting about any of whether economically or politically it makes sense. Actually, the logistics of trying to do it would be extremely difficult. And it, you know, it took them a number of years of preparation to get the euro together, you know, back, you know, a bit over 20 years ago, to actually get the thing off, 10 years ago, sorry, to get the thing off the ground. So and that was actually preparing to move to a common currency. To break it apart, I think, would be incredibly difficult. I mean, there was a large discussion when prior to the euro starting as to whether this was a sensible thing or not. With a lot of particularly US academics saying maybe this isn't such a good idea, and then the Europeans saying, well, it's all part of the euro project. And I think that's one thing to remember, is that the euro is not just an economic beast, it's actually a political beast. And it's part of, you know, one Europe. And so the political will is extremely strong. And you know, European policymakers continually say today, don't underestimate the strength of the political will in Europe to keep Europe together, obviously, given the experience of the past 100-plus years. So ultimately, I think that's the glue which holds things together, regardless of, you know, whether from a straight economic consideration it makes sense or not.
Well, having said that, is there a capacity within the financial system to actually forgive debt with some of those countries inside the...
Well, I mean, that's happened with Greece. So Greece has already had some debt write-downs,
yep,
and some buybacks where they haven't paid. So you haven't got 100 cents in the euro back.
Right.
So that can happen. Well, it did happen.
But only with that country. There are other countries that are teetering.
Well, the negotiations at the moment are around Cyprus, which is obviously incredibly small in the context of Europe.
Yep.
But so far, it's been Greece, and then at the moment they're working on, now that the Cyprus elections are just out of the way, and working on a support package for Cyprus.
All right, got a question over there.
Rebecca Bryce from ABC Radio Current Affairs. Just in relation to Europe, what do you think the uncertain Italian election result, what do you think the impact of that will be on the European economy, the world economy, and Australia as well?
It's still in a state of flux at the moment. Uncertainty is generally not good, I mean, I don't know. I think it depends on the outcome. Let me answer the question in a slightly different way. So what, if it's, from Australia's point of view, if Europe growth is a bit softer, that's actually not that big a deal for us. You know, they're not a particularly large trading partner for Australia. Obviously, we'd be much happier if Europe was growing stronger. That would be great. But the direct economic effects of Europe being a bit softer actually aren't that large for Australia. That said, and what the experience of the last couple of years shows is that when tensions flare in Europe, which sort of panics financial markets and panics people more generally, that's just not good for the global economy. So if that can be avoided, that would be a good thing. But from Australia's point of view at least, sort of selfish point of view, Europe being a bit softer is not such a big deal. What matters is whether it's much more the confidence effects both in financial markets and in the economy more generally.